Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. Co-voice Karen Dumas of the No BS NewsHour and Republican political strategist Jason Rowe join the team to discuss former Detroit Police Chief James Craig's anticipated entrance in the U.S. Senate race, among other political headlines in Michigan. Also, State Senator Mary Cavanaugh of Redford Township and co-owner Bob Milnerick of First Call Home Healthcare describe an urgency to scrap the 2019 auto insurance reforms drop-in long-term care reimbursements for catastrophic car accident survivors. Now, here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber and editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. I am Samantha Schreiber, and I am excited to be zooming in on a sunny early October day. Happy spooky season, everybody. We will have only two segments for today's episode, with the second one being a bit longer as we quite frankly dive deeper into the weeds of what exactly Senate Finance and Insurance Chair Mary Cavanaugh means when she talks about reforming the 2019 auto insurance reform to expand care accessibility for those catastrophically injured in car accidents. But of course, per usual, we are kicking off things with our roundtable discussion with visits from communication strategist and No BS NewsHour co-voice Karen Dumas. Hey, Karen, how are you today?
I'm fine, Sam. Good morning.
And we also have Republican political strategist Jason Rowe. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So let's kick off this conversation. And I find it a bit fun because Jason Rowe, the first time I ever met you, was talking about James Craig, the former Detroit police chief. And your energy is a bit different than our initial conversation back in 2021, I believe. So right now, the former police chief and disqualified 2022 gubernatorial candidate is currently smiling at a likely U.S. Senate bid to be announced this week. Can Craig attract the same type of intrigue he captured in the early days of his gubernatorial campaign? What do you think, Jason?
Not even close. I don't know why he's pursuing it based on his previous experience. As you refer, I was involved in recruiting him as one of the several candidates that ran. And on paper, obviously, he looked great. He had a lot of popularity in Southeast Michigan, was obviously a different kind of candidate for Republicans. And I think coming out of, the hostility to, the police departments and defunding and the perception of Detroit being having navigated the BLM protests pretty well and the perception that maybe crime was down looked good. But in practice, going from being a police chief to a statewide candidate is a leap that he was not prepared for. It's not entirely his fault. This is not something you spend decades in law enforcement and can just instantly become a statewide candidate in a party that you don't have very deep relationships. I don't think he really knew who was a grifter, who was sincere, didn't know who to trust. I think that's one of the reasons it took him so long to launch. But I think once he got into it, I don't know that he has the skill set as a retail politician. As one former deputy or one former sheriff told me, there's a big difference between police chiefs and sheriffs when it comes to retail politics. Chiefs are used to people coming up to them, whereas sheriffs who are on the ballot are used to going up to other people and working the room. And one of the criticisms of Craig was if he went to an event, he just sat at his table and didn't really engage and work the room. I long way to get to. I don't think the donors are there for him. I think he underwhelmed the donor class. I think Mike Rogers will suck up all of the traditional GOP money and fundraisers. And I think unless James Craig were to get the Donald Trump endorsement, I have no idea how he breaks beyond, maybe the mid-20s in Southeast Michigan and reaches voters throughout the state.
Karen, what are your hot takes on this updated buffet menu of U.S. Senate candidates? Can I say that? Well, can I say buffet?
Yeah, you can. It's interesting, and I think it's going to be even more interesting. Slotkin is viewed as the shoo-in here on the Democratic side, and Hill Harper is making his rounds, although quietly, while people are showing up to his events, and he has a lot of them. people are still trying to wonder why he's running and what he's actually going to bring to the table. So, you know, as voters and elections turn out, you never know until the end, until the outtake. But, you know, people are either split and totally, you know, for Slotkin, or still trying to waffle and figure out if there's some celebrity appeal in the Hill Harper camp.
Either you, anyone can jump in on this, but I do wonder if there are some similarities here between a possible Mike Rogers versus James Craig and a possible Lissa Slotkin versus Hill Harper, because it seems that Hill Harper and James Craig are both going to pull the, you know, I'm visible in Detroit card. They're both going to try to show themselves off as the more grassroots candidate versus this establishment. What are your kind of your thoughts on that observation?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, because people, one, feel like, you know, where did Hill Harper come from? You know, and while he has a business and he bought a house, you know, everybody's done the whole carpetbagger thing to be here in the city of Detroit. So I don't think that's the case. And unfortunately, I think former Chief Craig lost a lot of his Detroit base when he tried to tie his bandwagon to Trump so early on. I don't think people cared about him being a Republican, but that was just for a lot of people that followed him and supported him was kind of a turnoff. So I don't necessarily know. I don't necessarily think those will be the two things. You've got people that are just, you know, so democratically loyal that they're going to, you know, be in the Slotkin camp regardless, without question or compromise.
Yeah. And I think when it comes to this, it's less for the Democratic side about regionalism and more about ideology and race a little bit. On the ideology, you know, Alyssa Slotkin's never had a primary in her career. So she's gotten away with this image of being a centrist, even though she voted nearly 100% with Pelosi, 100% with Biden. But she never had to make any statements that undermined that. I think Hill Harper running on the progressive left of her is going to force her to have to genuflect to progressives for the first time in her career. And I don't think she can take him for granted. And that's where race comes in. You know, he's running as a Detroit Democrat. You've got obviously a large percentage of Black voters that are significant in the Democratic primary. And Black voters in Detroit got screwed by the redistricting process that left them within the city of Detroit without any Black representation. You know, the only Black congressional representation in Southeast Michigan is coming from a Republican. So I think there's something for him to tap in there, that you've got, you know, a white suburban woman coming into Detroit, a la, you know, Mallory McMorrow, displacing a Black voice at the federal level. So I think that could play into it as well. I completely agree with what Karen said about Craig. He, the only reason he even pretends that he can be a candidate is that he maintains some name ID in Metro Detroit. But once money starts getting spent on his record and on him, I think he shrinks. And I don't think he'll ever be able to raise the money to build up his image around the state to be competitive.
If I can just throw this in here, Sam, you know, you're talking about, you know, Black representation, and my column this week in the Detroit News is about redistricting as they head to federal court. But the argument when we keep talking about Black representation is that we are a predominantly Black city and we have a white mayor. So that really kind of, you know, makes that conversation unstable in certain instances. And that was part of my conversation with those that I interviewed, like, you know, it either has to be 100% or not at all.
I do just have one more James Craig question before we move on. Jason, you talked about relationships. You talked about a base. I mean, who exactly does James Craig know here anymore? Who are his friends right now? Does he have any, or is he even more bare than what he was in 2022?
I don't think there's any political professionals within the state of Michigan that care about winning that would take on his campaign. I don't think that there's donors that are going to take the risk given the performance of his gubernatorial campaign. And I think one of the, you know, things that Mike Rogers brings to the table is a comfort level where donors that know him. He's been an effective campaigner, an effective member of Congress. You know, he's been through the ringer and performed well. So there's not really a need for anybody else to, you know, step into the breach, because Mike Rogers checks a lot of boxes. If you look back over history of Michigan, too, both in Senate races and gubernatorial races, it's almost always the candidate is perceived to have more experience is more qualified or a technocrat, you know, a la Rick Snyder, aside from the 2018 election, which was kind of an anomaly in Michigan history. And when, you know, obviously Slotkin has an impressive resume and comes in as a very qualified candidate, but Mike Rogers does too. And he neutralizes an advantage that she's had in previous races. So I do think he matches up against her as well as anybody in the Republican field by a long mile.
Also, I forgot to state, we also have MERS editor Kyle Malin in the corner with us. Kyle, what's on your mind today?
I'm just silently in the corner, just hanging out here. I got to say, I agree with everything everybody said. I don't think we can take James Craig seriously as a candidate until he takes a campaign seriously. He didn't take that last campaign for governor seriously. He had a yellow brick road to the nomination, and he wandered off into the wilderness. He cannot raise money. He's not focused. He's just not a good candidate. He just isn't. He hasn't proven that he's been a good candidate. And I don't know how he can all of a sudden, after having everything gift wrapped for him, all of a sudden think that he's going to get the 15,000 signatures he needs to even get on the ballot. I question whether he can even get that far. I think who we really got to be talking about is Peter Meyer. Peter Meyer is going to have funding. We know he's going to be well endowed with West Michigan money. He will get on the ballot. And he's going to be, I think, the biggest challenge for Mike Rogers. And then the question becomes then, who does Trump get in for? Trump isn't going to back a loser, but he certainly doesn't want Peter Meyer to be the nominee either. So I think the question then becomes, does he go for Mike Rogers, or does he go to Nikki Snyder, or does he go to Mike Hoover? I mean, or does he try and just stay out of it because he doesn't want to back a loser?
Well, I mean, I'd be curious to hear what Karen and Jason have to think about this. I personally feel like Trump might not make any endorsements for 2024. I wonder if the time for Trump goodies is over as he focuses purely on himself.
Well, and I would say I think the Trump organization is a lot more competently managed right now than we've seen in the 2020 campaign or in the 2016 campaign. He's got Chris LaCivita and Susie Wiles kind of, you know, running the ship. And I think it's a much more disciplined operation. And I think they would probably push on him more to stay out of endorsing candidates that are unelectable. The four Senate races that Republicans had a real opportunity to pick up, Trump effectively picked the nominees and they all four went down in flames and cost us, you know, capturing the Senate. So I think there's a lot of risk and there's a lot of reward if he doesn't, because he's going to have better quality candidates running along with him if he's the nominee. And Mike Rogers is going to have a competent team. He's going to have resources. He's going to have all the tools to be a good statewide candidate. And I can't say that for any of the rest of the field as of this point.
I think Trump's focus has to be on Trump. And I agree with you, Sam. I don't think it's going to be or should be in terms of endorsements. He's got a different set of agenda items. But, you know, I have to say this because I like James Craig. I like him as a person. I think he has a lot to offer. It may not necessarily be in a political realm, but, you know, politics is very different. It's a dirty game, and people that are not familiar with it come in and can be penalized by it, as we saw with the signatures and just, you know, the whole orchestration of his or lack thereof of his earlier campaign. So, you know, if he wants to run, I mean, he certainly has the right and the opportunity to do so. But I hope he finds some place where he can actually lend some value.
Now, Karen, I know that you're going to be leaving us a bit earlier, so I want to talk to you about corporate incentives, because I feel like you might have some fun takes on this. I'm specifically thinking about how Ford has currently paused its Marshall electric vehicle battery plant project out of concerns around competitiveness. And this follows a ton of money that the state has provided to incentivize this plant. I'm talking more than $120 million to the Marshall Area Economic Development for Community Infrastructure Projects. I'm talking about the $772 million Renaissance Zone tax exemptions for the next 15 years, and oh so more. So as we talk about this current UAW strike, as Democrats in Michigan try to go back to their UAW union base, how do you do that while you have also voted on a ton of economic incentives for places like Ford?
Well, I mean, you know, we're talking sheer technology. We're talking a licensing agreement with China. We've got so many layers to this. I think that it's almost impossible to just segment those types of incentives or supports. You know, it's all blurred lines. But the UAW and Ford are playing. They're negotiating. They're playing tough at the table, which is what they're supposed to do. But I think that we've seen that people, especially our elected officials, they say one thing, they put dollars in another place, and then they turn around and do something completely different, and it doesn't seem to have very much repercussion. So I'm not really sure if it'll have any negative impact at all at the table. Again, I think it's a negotiation tactic. I said earlier, I think Sean Fein is either a psycho or he's a genius, you know, in his approach, and which one is going to be effective is going to be based on the outcome that comes. But I hate to say it, but I don't think people check the boxes the way that they should to see that all of these things don't align the way that they're presented. Does that make sense? You know, they say one thing, they do something else, none of that matches, and it doesn't seem to have an impact.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I was really interested in talking about this Ford Marshall plant pause, but then I listened to Off the Record and they were bringing up, like, is it really paused? Because even though it's not Ford doing the developments, there's a lot of other organizations, companies involved to set up before Ford even arrives.
Right. And from what I hear, the people in Marshall aren't necessarily big on having it coming there. We haven't heard a lot about that as well. There's some community pushback. So again, a lot of things are performative. A lot of statements are all based on, you know, what people are trying to get, and the deal that they're going after has very little to do with the reality of the deal.
But do you think Governor Whitmer and some of these other Democratic leaders in Michigan, do you think they've been a little bit more quiet than you would have expected for this already unprecedented UAW strike?
Either of you
could take that on. But I mean,
you know, listen, I think they've been out there as expected. But I think going to your point on the taxpayer subsidies of these corporations, I think it does change the way folks are going to look at it in the next election versus how they looked at it in the last election. Is Samantha and Kyle know, I was the strategist for Tom Barrett's campaign last time, and we were on the receiving end of a lot of attacks over Tom voting against the taxpayer subsidies of General Motors, $819 million in taxpayer money. And, you know, the Democrats and the Slotkin campaign perverted that into voting against GM jobs. Well, guess what? It's not GM jobs. It's LG, non-union jobs. So a lot of this money that we were shoveling to the auto industry with the promise of jobs turns out to be not union jobs. They are in a joint partnership with LG or with Goshen. And so it looks a lot different now. And I think going into 2024, the controversy around partnering with a Chinese communist-owned corporation, Goshen, and the fact that these are not going to UAW members, these new jobs, they're going to non-union contract workers. So it looks a lot different. I think the political debate going forward is going to look a lot different. And I think a lot of the Democrats that were championing these taxpayer subsidies of these global corporations aren't going to be so thirsty to champion them this next time around.
Aaron, before you go, I had a quick question for you on the mayor's race in Westland and Warren, since it impacts state legislators and it could impact the state house. What are you hearing as far as how Lori Stone is doing in Warren or Kevin Coleman is doing in Westland? And what's the temperature? Are they going to win?
Well, from what I hear, they have a pretty good chance. And, you know, that's going to take us back to what, a 54-54 split, which we haven't had for, you know, decade or so. But again, like Jason said earlier, when we talk about a pause, what is really going to be the impact there? You know, Tate will still have control of the agenda, and, you know, that period of time they're talking about accelerating, you know, certain bills and pausing those for a break. So I really don't know what, if any, impact it will have ultimately. But from what I'm hearing, they may actually have a viable shot in both of those cities, which would be interesting.
Well, you're right on that, I think, because if the legislature ends up having to adjourn early anyway in order to get the presidential primary bill to get effect.
Right.
You know, so what we're talking about, so we're losing out on some of November, we're losing out on December, and then January, the governor could set the special election for the primary, presumably the presidential primary. I mean, that's a possibility. And so you're only out a couple months, I suppose. So in the grand scheme of things, it may not be that big of a may not be as big as we might think it would be.
By the way, the way these Democrats have been legislating, I think if they're out for a few months, that's great news for Michiganders.
Spoken like a true Republican.
And on that note, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Karen. And Jason, are you good to stay on a little bit longer?
Yep, I got five more minutes.
Okay, perfect. I don't know. And I think a question I was trying to get at, though, and we're going to a lot of different boxes here, but I wonder, when you think about Governor Whitmer and these like economic incentives, I mean, the question is how do you, from a messaging standpoint, go from doing a press conference with Ford CEO Jim Farley, because you're giving him a $210 million competitive state funded grant, and then months later, you're saying, you know, I am a union supporter and we need to take on these corporate big shots. And how does that work from a messaging standpoint?
Well, it doesn't. I think they're twisted up in a lot of ways. I mean, on the political side, they're twisted up between environmentalists and organized labor, which are two of their biggest constituencies, and not everyone's going to be satisfied. But I think for, you know, politicians like Whitmer, who, let's face it, got embarrassed by Ford announcing their multi-billion dollar investments in southern non-union states without even notifying the state of Michigan that these expansions in electric vehicles were even taking place, which led to the creation of the SOAR program and led to her shoveling billions of dollars into the coffers of these auto companies. She, you know, is desperately trying to keep them in the state. You know, I think it's funny that she has to bribe the corporations and she's had to create a new commission to beg Michiganders not to move away. You know, we lost another congressional seat. I think we've lost a congressional seat in each of the last three census. So, you know, things that are happening in this state are forcing people to leave this state. And so she's trying to bribe and coerce people to stay here when it really is the policies of the state of Michigan that are driving these people away. But she can't beat up on the autos too hard when she's with one hand offering them money, begging them to stay and reinvest in the state. But at the same time, she is relying on a political constituency that helped put her in the governor's office. And I still am not convinced that Joe Biden will be the nominee for the Democrats in 2024. And she doesn't want to alienate organized labor, which is going to be very significant, particularly if Sean Fain and UAW get their way. They're going to be really, I think, re-empowered and going to be on the march.
Let's go back to what Kyle brought up. And Kyle, I want to hear your hot takes too. The date that I'm hearing when the state legislature is going to adjourn is November 2nd. Of course, when you ask a lawmaker that, they say, well, I'm hearing rumors. It's a rumor. But, you know, it's kind of interesting thing about the messaging standpoint. Who do people try to make the villain out of this? Do they make the Democratic leadership a villain, Joe Tate and Senator Winnie Brinks? Do they make the people running for mayor the villain? Do they somehow try to say like Republicans are the villain because they could have been more productive and given certain things immediate effect? What are you noticing with the messaging here?
Well, I think they're probably going to say the Republicans, but there's also just the general realization that I'm not sure the general public really cares when the legislature adjourns. I think it's kind of a side issue that maybe they're tangentially aware of, but it really doesn't impact them. Most legislatures are part-time. I think the bigger question will be is if one of these mayoral candidates doesn't win, does Governor Whitmer go ahead and do a special session? They need to adjourn early in order for the presidential primary and arguably other bills, I suppose, to go into effect. Proposal 2 in particular, implementation bills, those should be going into effect as well. But there's a whole whole December where the governor could ask for one or two things. And to ask for more than that is asking too much. But she could ask for one or two things, and that would give the Democrats an opportunity to just focus on those things and get them done. Because what we're seeing right now is particularly progressive Democrats, their brain is exploding with things that they want to get done. It's all over the place, and you can't get it all done. The legislative process doesn't work that way. The legislative process can focus on a couple things at a time, and that's it. When you try and juggle 8, 5, 6, 10 balls up in the air, they all fall to the ground. So if they can focus on a couple things, which I know that the speaker and the majority leader have a couple things in mind that they'd like to do and get those done first, then other things will have to get prioritized, not in December, but in 2024. And then you got to focus on if you're Democrats, win a majority again, so you can do it in 25 and 26.
Okay, I know you have to go now, Jason, but one thing for you. Proposal 1 implementation bills. What yes. happened? What's the holdup?
Yeah, what did happen? That was the single biggest vote getter in Michigan last election with 66% of the vote, polled higher than Governor Whitmer or Prop 3. And the legislature, of which Winnie Brinks and Joe Tate supported Proposal 1 on the ballot, have failed to bring it up. And what we see with the scandals surrounding Angela Whitmer having, you know, lobbying clients that are getting earmarks from the state of Michigan as she presides as chair of the Appropriations Committee, sweetheart deals for leased Cadillacs and other things that Proposal 1, if enacted, would make sure that voters know where their legislators are getting their money. And so far, Speaker Tate and Leader Brinks have dragged their feet on putting together a package to enact that proposal. And I think that the media and Republicans should be turning up the heat on them, because this Whitworth thing could be the tip of the iceberg of other corruption within the legislature. And it could be affecting Republicans too. I don't know. But the reality is 66% of Michiganders said we want public disclosure of for our elected officials, and the legislature, you know, while being very aggressive on every other thing coming down the pike, has done nothing on this so far.
And just to reiterate, Proposal 1 was the one to require legislators to implement annual financial reporting requirements for themselves, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. So this isn't anything such as, say, like new major FOIA package. This is very much just financial disclosures that voters had approved, correct?
Correct, yeah. And there's only a handful of states that don't require state legislators to disclose where they get their personal income. So we have no idea when a legislator, a committee chairman, is voting on something that they have a financial stake in, and voters deserve to have that level of transparency.
Well, Jason, I know that we're near the end here and you have to go, but I guess, do you have any additional things you'd like to say or any hot takes going into October 2023?
I would say to the previous question, Kyle, I agree. I don't think the voters care, think much about when the legislature adjourns. I don't think Republicans will take the blame, because the Democrats have been running roughshod over Lansing. They've passed a very ambitious and progressive agenda already. They've alienated a lot of constituencies that were prepared to align with them. And so I think that the Democrats are going to be in real jeopardy of losing their majority, if not because of these special elections temporarily. But in the long term, I think that Matt Hall and Republicans are going to have the financial resources and the momentum to take back the House.
Now, well, thank you so much for your time, Jason. Again, this is Republican political strategist Jason Rowe. And earlier we were with No BS News, our co-voice Karen Dumas. Thank you all for your time and participation on our program.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
For our latest segment of the MERS Monday podcast is State Senator Mary Kavanaugh, a Redford Township Democrat, and Bob Melnarek, the co-owner of First Call Home Healthcare in Clinton Township. Both have been on the podcast before, but today they're here together to discuss Senator Kavanaugh's legislation to significantly adjust Michigan's 2019 auto insurance reform. Part of the reform's formula, which aimed to change the state's culture of record high cost to legally drive, was capping personal attendant care to 56 hours per week and a more than 45% reduction in reimbursements paid for by Michigan insurers for non-Medicare patients' long-term care if they were catastrophically injured in a car accident. A Michigan Supreme Court ruling from over the summer clarified that those catastrophically injured before 2019 would maintain the same pre-capped long-term care coverage, but that ruling does not apply to those injured after 2019, so in the last 4 years and moving forward. Senator Kavanaugh, you're introducing legislation to modify the 2019 reform, but my big question for you today is, how so? What exactly does that mean?
Hi, so I'm glad that you asked, and I really appreciate you inviting me on the podcast just so we can talk a little bit about some really good legislation that I was able to introduce in the past couple days. So this legislation, it's Senate Bill 530 and 531. I won't get too into the weeds. I know we might be doing that a little bit later in the podcast. But so in summary, I really just think that this legislation that was proposed in the bills would address the reimbursement structure under the Medicare fee. It would also establish consistent rates among providers. It also established a new non-Medicare fee schedule. And this essentially is creating a fair and reasonable rate structure to ensure specialized care is readily available. And as you said in your intro, is there was a 2019 auto no-fault reform. And I do believe that intent was not only to make pathways of affordability by giving the consumer options, but also the intent was to structure a reasonable and fair and sustainable fee structure and fee schedule. And I think that we saw options and over the past couple years and after the court decision that you mentioned, that it's time to fulfill the commitment that we made in that 2019 intent of a reasonable, fair, and sustainable fee schedule that allows access to care.
Now, Bob, we have you on because obviously this is an issue that you have been advocating for quite some time since 2019. But additionally, you are a home care provider yourself. Could you talk a little bit about what that reimbursement in the 2019 reform has meant for you and your services you can provide?
Well, basically, the part of the law that affected the long-term care that we provide to our patients, and when this happened in 2019, I had about 50 to 55 catastrophic auto patients. What it did is it changed our reimbursement system from what is reasonable and customary to what the insurance lobby is saying was a fee schedule. So the fee schedule that they imposed was not really a schedule. It was a 45% cut to our 2019 reimbursement rates. And for example, in 2019, we were charging $28 for a basic home health aid. And now we're 4 years later after COVID and inflation and a national shortage of caregivers, we're being reimbursed $15.40. So it didn't really, it was not really a fee schedule. This 45% cut basically eliminated the benefit for the persons that choose unlimited policies if they're ever into a catastrophic accident.
Now, when you were on this podcast series last year, you talked about how First Call Home Healthcare was about to close its doors. And what is the current situation now?
Well, we had a very rough year. We could not just let go of our patients as soon as this fee schedule went into effect in July of 2021. These patients had nowhere to go. And we were working feverishly in the legislature to try to convince them that this was unsustainable and untenable. But after 10 months, we ended up having to discharge all of our auto crash patients. And we limped along until the Supreme Court finally ruled and said ultimately that we were right, that this was not supposed to be applied to those patients. So we survived. We're still digging out of the hole. And it's been a really rough road, but we're still here.
Senator Kavanaugh, I think something interesting I've learned about you in the last week is that you were a home care provider, correct? And that's why this issue is very near and dear to your heart.
Yeah, and so I was a worker, so I was not a provider of direct care, but prior to my service, working in the legislature, prior to when I was a House member, I was a direct care worker for physically and mentally disabled Michiganders. And so I really saw, or was at least able to see the firsthand, the level of care that is needed and importance of access to this care, not only for the individuals. I mean, I would see their families come in. I would see the quality of life for the patient or the individual that I was assisting, and the quality of life of the families and the loved ones that knew that they didn't have the capacity to take care of them, as well as the home that I was working in, as well as the workers that I was working around. And I think it gave them a peace of mind and not feel alone in these moments of need. And so seeing that, I know that that is what is essential. And I think Bob touched on it a little bit, that since 2019, we really saw that crisis of care, and we saw home care and these facilities close their door and having to turn away the most needed survivors of these auto accidents. And I do think that we may have survived the other side, but I did want to uplift that, unfortunately, we really have seen real life and death consequences from the 2019 unintended consequences of the lack of access of care that it created, where a survivor, Brian Song, was he actually passed away right before the Summer and Derry decision. And it was said to be due to his care being stripped, his lifelong personal caregivers being priced out, and one even that's been with him for decades. And so just hearing stories like that and being in the House and now serving in the Senate, I thought it was the perfect opportunity as chair of insurance to really take these stories, these really life, real life instances, and the future. I mean, this, with the decision that happened in the summer, that made the decision for pre-2019. And now we're talking about post-2019, that's 4 years and the future of anyone that might be injured in auto accidents. And so I just think that the intention wasn't to put cost above all. It was really to make sure that there's options for affordability, but also we allowed access for that care for the people that need us most and the most vulnerable people in our communities.
Now, the number I've been hearing of when the legislature could adjourn for 2023 is November 2nd. Now, in your capacity as chair of the Senate Finance, Insurance, and Consumer Protection Committee, what type of timeline are you envisioning for this legislation?
I think that's a really good question. And I have also heard some rumors, but I will say my hope is to get this done before we adjourn this year. And I think I'll leave it up to you to speculate that timeline more specifically. But I really do want to be deliberate. We are hearing from stakeholders and listening to who has been negatively affected by the unintended consequences of the 2019 reform, but also understanding the urgency of families, providers, access of care, and even survivors who are currently being negatively impacted without this legislation being in place. So I think every piece of legislation needs to be vetted, needs to be looked at and well thought out. But when we can see the people struggling and unable to locate care right in front of us, I think change is urgent, needed, and critical.
Since the Andary Supreme Court decision basically reinstated care for all those injured prior to June 2019, there have been several cases where we have had to turn down patients. And this summer, we actually had 1 week where we turned down 10 catastrophic patients in 1 week. The Catastrophic Claims Association, the MCCA, states there are about 1,000 people a year that enter their system. That means that their medical bills from a catastrophic injury have exceeded $635,000. So about three people per day are coming into our arena requesting our types of services. So that means if you look back to June of 2019, there's already about 4,300 survivors that are struggling for care, and three more every day. So when we say urgency is a important, you know, three people per day, every day, 365 days a year. It's urgent.
Now, I do kind of want to get into the weeds here, and either Bob or you, Senator, can answer this. When you talk about this idea of a fee schedule, what does that exactly mean in terms of financial numbers?
So in other national fee schedules or private payers, Medicare has a fee schedule of codes, and depending on the geo codes, this is how much they reimburse. The Veterans Administration has a fee schedule. Medicaid has a fee schedule. Blue Cross has a fee schedule. And those fee schedules are actual numbers with codes, and they depend on the acuity of the patient, the geographic area of how much they reimburse. The problem is that many of the services that these types of patients require long-term do not have a Medicare equivalent payment amount. So therefore, the only way that we can establish a fee schedule is really to look at all of the different national schedules. There's not one schedule that we can look to that has everything that we need. But when you take a look at the VA or Medicare in some instances and Blue Cross, you can see generally what commercial payers and government payers are paying for very, very similar services. So our fee schedule that we're proposing really takes into account those. And it also takes into account how it was formulated, was that we took the 2018, 2019, 2020 rates before this fee schedule was implemented. We took the reimbursements that were regularly, willingly, and accepted by insurance companies and paid. And then we added inflation to those rates in the last 3 years. So that's how we arrived to the numbers that are in the fee schedule.
Yeah, and if I can add, touching a little bit about my bill or the legislation proposed, now that Bob kind of gave a little bit of a background of why fee schedules and where do they come from? So these bills would raise that Medicare reimbursement rate for these accident-related medical care. And so that's when we're talking about like physicians, hospitals, clinics, and other accredited providers. So it raises their reimbursement rates so they can operate effectively and give the services needed, but it also creates a new rates for non-Medicare covered services and also personal caregivers. And so this is also for, it would scrap that 40, I think it was 47 around or a little bit more cut in reimbursement rate that the 2019 blanketed over their imposed fee schedule. And so it creates a little bit more of the specific dollar amounts depending on the type of care and services provided. Because what we really saw under current law, also the 2019 changes, so this is current law, was that cutting providers by over 47% did not create an effective fee schedule or even an effective checks and balances of prevention of the overcharging, or it really just stripped drivers of the main reason for auto insurance, if you ask me, is the once you're faced with, let's just a catastrophic moment, you and your family and future have the means and access of care. And so with a blanketed cut of that large to different types of care and services provided, we really just tried to address that within our within the bills that I proposed as far as when it comes to that fee schedule that was created.
Okay, so just to confirm, and I might ask for quite a bit of a reiteration here, but so no longer that more than 45% reduction in reimbursements paid for by Michigan insurers for non-Medicare patients' long-term care. Instead, that is switched out with a, and correct me if I'm wrong, I want to make sure I got this right, a fee schedule that is based off of the type of care, so hospital, at-home provider, et cetera, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So Bob, I know that you talked about how pre-2019 reform, you were getting reimbursed with over $28, I'm assuming, per hour, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and then it went down to around $15. So what would this look like for you in what you're able to, what does that fee schedule, what are you kind of imagining that to look for your own company?
Well, that $28 would go up to about $35, and our nursing rates would all go up from amounts that are below sustainable to what we can justify is fair and reasonable compared to other schedules and compared to what we were receiving regularly, willingly, plus inflation over the last 4 years. And in fact, we didn't even in the calculations count the 2023 inflation, which was by DIFS 9.66%. So we were very reasonable. Our goal was to come in with a schedule that is defensible and sustainable, because we don't want to be back here 5 years from now and saying that our prices are too high. So we wanted to come in with something very reasonable, very defensible, and something that will continue the sustainability of the system.
So, Senator Kavanaugh, I know that this legislation was recently introduced, but what are kind of some numbers you're hearing in terms of fiscal impact and what this could do for insurance rates across all drivers?
Well, we're actually trying to get a little bit of a handle of how much the cost may go up, because that is the number one thing we're kind of hearing as far as feedback from the insurance companies. But we are not seeing expected to see a large increase when it comes to premiums, just because this specific amount, this specific legislation touches on PIP. And so that's personal injury protection. And personal injury protection actually is one of the lowest things that affects the premium. And so when we're talking about either controlling costs or what we might see as far as the premiums, this specifically is just something that even Michiganders can see that this will continue to keep those options of affordability, but also give you that availability for care despite the coverage needed. So we're not seeing too much of an increase, but we are asking insurance companies who are at the table and we are having conversation with since introduction, is that they are worried about necessary to control costs of the 2019 reform, and they're just worried about certain premiums going up. And so we did our due diligence, and we also are looking at the fact that now Michiganders are choosing lower, more affordable PIP coverage. They're still not going to receive the coverage possible, even if they choose the largest PIP coverage. And so as we talked about lower rates, we're really just trying to see if that's still expected, because it was not dramatically reduced by what was said as far as in the 2019. And I know insurance premiums have gone up over the course of the entire country due to more accidents, the cost of repairs, and those are the big ticket items that are going to have a really big influence on your premiums. But it's also, I think it's an even more reason to secure Michiganders with this safety and this accessibility to care. If Michigan's a really big driving state, and if we are seeing more accidents on the road, we need to be able to make sure that people are cared for, even if they do choose the biggest premium to the smallest premium, that they have the access of care that they are paying for and that's available. I think, like I said earlier, is that even if they choose the biggest, what we are seeing now is that because we really cut the fee schedule and providers at the knees, we're seeing people having to close their doors, say no to survivors, even if that affordability is there, even if they are required of that care. It's not like they can't afford it at this moment with the insurance. It's because they can't find the access to care. So I don't think I'm too worried on it raising as far as premiums or anything that Michiganders would see other than some positive reinforcement that you can be a little bit at ease on the road now, knowing that if something happens, because nobody plans for an accident like this, if something happens, you have that access of care in the state of Michigan.
I can add to that. You know, right now the MCCA expenditures are about $1 billion a year, a little bit less, maybe about 900 million. There's 22 billion in the MCCA fund. And I would like to remind the audience that that money that's in the MCCA fund is the driver's money. The drivers pay an extra fee that goes into that fund. And if they're ever injured, it's there for their care. So that is the driver's money, and the insurance industry's only job with the MCCA is to administer it. So if you look at what our bill is trying to fix, it only affects the people that are choosing unlimited. So the choice is always still going to be there. People can opt out of the unlimited. But what we're saying is that if you are going to pay the unlimited, and most of our bill affects only the MCCA fee, which right now is $122 a year. It reached its highest in 2019, 2020 at $220 a year. And it's feasible to say that, you know, that fee is going to increase a little bit when we're restoring the care. There was about a $300 million cut in long-term care. That's why we're here, is the law essentially cut about $300 million a year out of expenditures. And if you look at the $300 million a year compared to the total amount that all Michigan drivers pay for auto insurance, which is about $18 billion a year, it's less than 1%, the entire thing. And so if we restore this care for people, it's not unfeasible to say that the MCCA rate would go up $3, $4 a month for people that choose unlimited.
You know, I am a little bit curious, Senator Kavanaugh. I mean, what do you imagine the governor's willingness to be to get behind this? Because I know that the 2019 auto insurance reform is something that she's campaigned on. It's something that she has celebrated as a bipartisan victory from 2019. What are your thoughts on, you know, maybe not even just the governor, but incumbent legislators that still view that 2019 auto insurance as one of their biggest successes?
Well, I'm actually excited about that. And I really appreciate the question, Sam, just because I do think that this legislation that I proposed it builds on the changes of the 2019 legislation. It really seeks to improve the intent and what the legislature was trying to do. And everyone that was in support was to increase accessibility to affordable post-acute home care, and even home care limitations. Is they never wanted to get rid of it. They just kind of wanted to create an option for affordability because, for example, I cover the area of Detroit. And so Detroit was a large factor as far as in the 2019 reform, because people aren't driving around because they don't want to have insurance. It's because they were priced out and it was unaffordable. And they had to buy groceries or pay for childcare. And so this was an option. And so I really think it builds on the steps that we were doing in 2019. And it really offers a beacon of hope of lessening the burden of this most vulnerable population that we have been seeing suffering the unintended consequences. But if I could add, I was very excited by introduction. We had 13 Dems, but we also had 3 Republicans. And that was before we were able to hear it in committee, before we were able to talk about the issues. I know Senator Huizenga walked up to me after introduction because he really wanted to make sure that this is going to be a fix that we have all been looking for, because nobody wanted this to happen, I believe, under the 2019 reform. And so these issues are impacting every district in Michigan, and members have been pretty vocal, Democrat, Republican, House, or Senate, on the need to revisit the impacts to injured residents. And I very much look forward to talking and working out some of the issues that they may have or may see or questions that they might have on the legislation. But as far as when it comes to the governor, I do know I'm hopeful because in the past, she has signaled and been open about the support of possible legislative changes on the 2019 reform to further the intent of the bills.
Are you willing, both as a chair and as a bill sponsor, to see this legislation go to the floor without support from the insurance associations?
I think I am willing, but I am hopeful that we can have conversations. I do know that when I entered the Senate as chair of insurance, I heard from several insurance companies because I entered the House post this decision. So I wasn't on record, and I think they wanted to get a little feelers. And so I was meeting with several insurance companies, as well as several home care, and We Can't Wait. But the insurance companies regarded or they mentioned the need for fee schedule adjustment. But the fear, I think the fear that they added was they're worried about unqualified or legislators choosing arbitrary numbers. So as I was working on this over the last few months, I was adamant about the coalition of stakeholders that we had in the rooms and have been working on longer than myself in the Senate, but that what was proposed and what we were going to introduce was data-driven, provides the supports needed for access of care, and would not have any inflation rates. Because I really wanted to avoid optics of favorability or create an unfair fee structure. And exactly what I believe Bob was mentioning earlier was we don't want to come back to this. We really just want to fix what is needed, what is fair, and making sure that every Michigander, no matter if it's a peace of mind on the road or care after a detrimental accident, is that you know that there's care available and it's possible here in Michigan.
You know, because we are up there in time, I think I want my final question to be for you, Bob. I know that an ongoing critique of that 2019 reform is people not being at the negotiation table, specifically when it came to home care providers. But what are the biggest lessons learned of 2019, and what makes you feel confident that this year is going to be different for you all?
Well, our industry stance back in 2019 was a little different. It was basically no changes. And you know, now it's much different. I think there's a whole group of new people that are involved in the process. And we have had one goal in mind, and that is to come up with a very, very fair, defensible fee schedule that is the minimum of what we need to take care of the policyholders of the insurance companies. And we are willing to sit down with the insurance companies and go over anything they want to ask, and every rate that we have, we can point to something that is already out there in a national schedule, or something that they have already paid willingly without court action, and plus inflation. So we know our bill is very fair. It's a minimum of what we need to help these people, you know, regain some sort of a life.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Bob Milnarek and Senator Mary Kavanaugh. Thank you for joining us today on the MERS Monday podcast to describe this legislation and really kind of walk me through the weeds here.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning roundtable participants, co-voice Karen Dumas of the No BS News Hour, and Republican political strategist Jason Rowe. Additionally, thank you to State Senator Mary Kavanaugh of Redford Township and co-owner Bob Milnarek of First Call Home Healthcare. I'd also like to give a huge thanks to MERS editor Kyle Malin, and post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Schreiber, and in celebration of it being October 2nd, here is some spooky, spooky music. Happy early Halloween.